Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is the Miles Davis Radio Project. Miles Davis, the 70s and 80s, retirement and rebirth.
You got my everything, man.
Oh, we go, Miles.
Physical demands of playing the trumpet. First of all, you have this brass mouthpiece that goes up against your lip, and your lips are supposed to vibrate while this mouthpiece is on there. And if you use too much pressure, the lips will stop vibrating. In order to get the lips to vibrate at a fast rate, you have to have a lot of air velocity, especially to produce notes in the upper register of the trumpet. The air has to really be moving. And I think Miles, back in the 40s, if you look at pictures of him with Charlie Parker, you'll notice his posture is very different than the way it is now. His posture was perfect. You can't fault his posture. Now Miles bends over, plays at the floor. How he developed his current posture and why he did, I don't know. I can only venture a guess. And that would be to say that he started playing in those positions only in order to express himself the way he wanted to. He didn't feel he could do it by standing up straight and playing the horn straight.
Of the 60s. Rock and roll and electric music were on the rise. Miles Davis, the great jazz star of the two previous decades, was experimenting.
To be an inventor, until the invention is acceptable, you're considered a fool. Now, it ends up being a thin line from a fool to a genius.
Everybody followed Miles. There are a lot of people would have no idea how important Miles was to music. He's easily, I think, the most important musician within the last 50 years. I really believe that. I mean, he had such a profound effect on music in general, rock and roll. He's the one that first brought this fusion thing together.
Many of his fans were confused. Jazz always represented a higher level of music to them, a higher level of sophistication. Miles, with his exquisite trumpet style, decked out in expensive Italian cut suits, had once embodied this sophistication. Later, he was a symbol of rising black consciousness. But now his fans and critics wanted to know, why was he playing and dressing like a rock and roller?
I remember when Bitches Brew came out and he started to lose his generation. Like, again, my brother says he hasn't done anything since 1966.
Hey, Miles was a rebel. You know, it seems like he almost deliberately did things to upset a lot of jazz critics, for example. You know, yeah, hey, he says, jazz is like America. Supposed to be free.
Well, he once said to me, and I don't know if he was serious or not, before Bitches Brew, that he was getting pretty damn angry about how these white guys made so much money, and they weren't even musicians, and he was going to show that he could do it too, and he's done it.
He can do things like, he can electrify you, man, next thing he'll pull the floor out from underneath you and tell you to play, you know? That ain't the same kind of Miles Davis I hear now, or hear about. I don't hear anybody talking about that kind of magnetism or anything like that, and it's not because of him. Is what he's doing. But he's still my main man. And it's a biggie. My main man with his saltpeter music.
It's been known historically, a lot of times, especially here in America, we don't get into something until it is old and dead. I would hate for Miles to be dead before we realize the greatness that existed in the music that he's doing right now while he's alive.
Well, I'll never forget how I felt when I first heard the music, you know. You know, knowing that I was on the right track, you know. Little did I know then, you know, after I found out how it was really supposed to go, I mean, it just added to what I knew, you know. It's, you know what I mean? It still makes me feel good, you know, just to get a band and just make it sound good, you know what I mean? Without a doubt, you know, even if they fuck up, it sound good, you know? That's the way it is now.
In 1968, Miles broke off a long romance with actress Cicely Tyson and married a young singer named Betty Mabry, some 20 years his junior. Betty was Miles' window into the emerging world of rock, its anti-conventions, its hallucinogenic drugs, day-glow fashions, and its howling blues guitars. This guitar sound was a derivative of the African-American blues tradition, a sound Miles had been steeped in since childhood.
To learn to sustain and make a guitar sound like a voice, which is what we're all trying to do, because the voice is the ultimate instrument, it's the closest to the heart.
Guitar legend, Carlos Santana.
That's what Miles is, it's a singer, you know, his music sounds like Johnny Hooker also when he moans. Johnny Hooker moaning says a whole lot more than a lot of people that they're poets, you know, just one moan. So, his voice is really what got to me, and then later on, of course, is the articulation and the way it's, Art Blakey or somebody would say the way they scramble the eggs, you know, but first it was tone.
Miles was the modern language that I wanted to hear. He was the language polished up, you know, like Louis was. He had polished up the blues language on the trumpet.
Mississippi-born trumpeter, Olu Dara.
I have a mute in here. So I had no trouble when I heard Miles play. He was, if he had a guitar, he would have been playing guitar music. Then Miles do stuff like this. See, guitar does things like that. You know, same thing. He take the mute. Give it a metallic sound. See? That's all it is.
Carlos Santana.
I don't know if a lot of people in this country has ever had the experience of sucking on a sugar cane, you know, and getting the juice out, you know. And Miles does that, and so does blues players do that, like from Chicago or T1 Walker. They're like... And then they keep getting inside on it till they get the juice out. And when they get the juice out of the note, you know it, and I know it, and everybody knows it, you know, and it's it's again, they're not playing over the, they're not playing over the, over the note. They're getting inside of it. Like, he plays the blues is still Lightning Hopkins, you know, and it's still the God Bucket cut and shoot crowd, you know, that I love, you know. I don't and he has that, man. He definitely has that tone, but what he also brings to it is that elegance things that, that Duke Ellington has. It's not, it's God Bucket, but it has Tiffany's, man. It ain't cheap like Woolworths. It's got that real one of a kind phrasing, and it makes, brings it all together.
For me, there's no music that is not African except classical music.
Nigerian saxophonist and band leader, Fela.
Rock and roll, Caribbean music, Afro-Cuban, everything is African music. It's just that it was, they were developed outside Africa by those who were Africans but lived on a different environment.
And Africans, the things they do with beats.
Miles Davis.
There's certain things they do, man, that you can only do if you were born there, you know? Like, they'll play a pattern, and the next time the pattern comes around, they add another note to a certain part of that pattern. It might be in the middle of the pattern. You know what I mean? And then, and they keep on, the next time it comes around, they add a note, I mean another beat, and another part of the pattern, plus the one they already added. You know? And if you ain't born in that shit, you would say, what? Who?
Poet Quincy Troup.
I think the 1960s brought a change in Miles' music. The position that he had started to go to people like Sly and Jimi Hendrix. You see, those new rebels who came in, who personified the 60s, you know. And Miles, instead of setting the trend, and setting the trend like he had been doing for a number of years, and he began to follow some people. And it was a moment there, a period there of insecurity. He began to look for other ways to play.
The focus of Miles' attention at this time was on the young black guitarist Jimi Hendrix. He saw immediately that Hendrix was in the process of reinventing the electric guitar and the blues. Miles was interested not only in Hendrix's sound, but in his manner, his overt sexuality, and soon his huge commercial success. Popular music would never be the same. Bassist David Holland.
I played with Jimmy too a little, on a session we did, I don't know, in 70 or something. But the method of working was the same as with Miles. You know, it was like the way Jimmy put a thing together, he'd play things to you, you know, and or start something up, and then you'd pick it up. And then when he wanted something else to happen, he'd set it up from his guitar, you know. So I was immediately, you know, struck by that, you know, that they both had a very similar way of putting together their music.
Brazilian percussionist Ayrton Moreira.
Miles, he liked the way Jimi Hendrix played, and Miles started the Wawa because of Jimi Hendrix. And they were friends, they knew each other and everything. And one day he just showed up with the Wawa pedal. And then he would just go crazy on that Wawa pedal, man.
Listening to Hendrix, it always made me wonder what would happen if guys like Miles ever added that kind of beat to their music. What would happen? And you know what? It happened.
Producer George Duke.
I heard a record come out, and that's exactly what was happening. I said, wow. I said, it is possible to put it together. If Miles did it, that gave everybody else the freedom to do it, because Miles was the master. You know, if Miles led the way, all these other musicians would try it.
The record was Bitches Brew, and it was one of the first to fuse jazz and rock and roll, using electronic instruments and the techniques of the modern multi-track recording studio. Before this time, one of the hallmarks of Miles' recording style had always been to get a tune down in one or two takes. No inserts, no overdubs, no looking back. He had a magical ability to coax great performances from his bands. Now, though, new recording technologies allowed for different approaches in the studio. With Bitches Brew, Miles took advantage of them. Drummer Lenny White.
Zal Newell had some charts. And then what we would do is we would play for a while. He'd strike up the rhythm and play for a while, and then Miles would stop. And then he'd start it up again, and we'd play. And then he'd stop, and he'd start it up again. And everybody would take their solo. And then when T.O. went into the studio, like, they took all these things and they put it together and made it one continuous, complete piece.
CBS recording engineer who worked on Bitches Brew, Stan Tonko.
But, I mean, he would never come in with a fixed format and say, well, this is the album I want to make, and it's going to be so long, and we're going to do this piece and that piece and that piece. Never worked that way. We just came in, we did sessions. And between then and the next session, Miles would come into the editing room with T.O. They would listen, they would analyze it, do editing on it, and that would give them an idea of what they had and what they wanted to achieve in the next session. That's why, to this day, I don't even know myself which sessions we used for specific albums.
Recording engineer Ray Moore.
If he wants to come in and splice, it's all right with me. So he was doing that. And it appeared to me that we were taking out all the bass solos. And we were checking out some spots. And he, in the music, I guess before a bass solo starts, he points to what would have been a three if you were counting. Three in a measure. And he wanted to cut out there. And then after I marked that, reel off a minute or so of tape, or 2 minutes, whatever it was, and then he'd look at me and say, why don't you come in right there? And I said, Miles, if I come in right there where you pointed, I'm going to come in on a four. So I'm going out on the three, coming in on a four. We're going to have a beat missing. He looked at me, and he says, makes no fucking difference. Who the hell's going to know? Cut it.
Thank you. Bitches Brew was a huge commercial success, selling over 500,000 copies in its first year, while most jazz albums sold only 10,000.
Miles did, in fact, bring it all back home with his Bitches Brew band.
The Grateful Dead's Phil Lesh.
It was one of the first all-electric bands. They had an electric bass, electric guitars, and electric pianos. It was so unlike any jazz group that had ever existed before, because it had multiple instruments, for one thing, sometimes two guitars, sometimes two pianos, sometimes two drummers. It kept changing, and the music was completely simultaneous. In other words, it was more like free jazz with a boogaloo groove than it was like any other kind of jazz that had occurred before that. And it was revolutionary in that it wasn't so much exploratory as it was synthetic. It brought together many different ways of looking at music. One of the major achievements in music of our century, if I may say so.
I can't stand the music. Music awful.
Saxophonist Andrew White.
Now I haven't addressed this yet about his business, you know, but you know there's a tremendous business aspect of his whole decision to go over there. But you know, as legend has it, if he weren't selling enough records with Wayne Shorter and Tony Williams and them, the man just took him in the studio and said, "Well, this, if you want an advance, you know, this is what you're gonna have to play to get some money, you know." And so that's the way it all started, you know. But that has nothing to do with the music.
With the album Bitches Brew, Miles had gone over to rock and opened up a Pandora's box to the jazz world. Musicians could either follow Miles and make the money, or stay true to jazz and stay poor. The word sellout was in the air. Saxophonist Gary Bartz.
I probably thought that he was selling out. Now later, after the fact, I got into Jimi Hendrix, and I saw how bad he, you know, he was a great musician. But because of my background, you know, jazz, coming from jazz, I couldn't accept a rock musician being on the level of a Coltrane or Miles. See, Miles could see that. At that time, I couldn't see it.
Jazz writer Nat Hentoff.
You can't take away from Miles what he is, so that he can play half a chorus. And you want to hear some more, and then the noise comes in. And I mean noise. I mean, Ellington used to say, it sounds corny, there are only two kinds of music, good and bad. And I think that's bad music.
George Duke.
Critics wore him out because he started putting the rock thing in his music. And then when he put the funk thing in his music, people said, "What is Miles doing?" You know, and he lost a lot of fans, but he stuck to his guns. That's what he wanted to do.
Singer and songwriter Joni Mitchell.
You put on a Miles record and it does something to you. And because it does something to you, you go out and buy the next. You put it on. If it doesn't do something to you, right away, instantly, you may not be ready for the changes that that album contains. You may come back to it 10 years later and have gone through the appropriate life changes to be able to channel that communication, because your life and it match now. You know, like where, you know, you miss time with ideas and things, you know. That's the trouble. If you get too far in the pop arena, to stay on the beam with the public is impossible, because they get a concept of you and they can't see anything you do for the concept of you. You're the same face, you're the same name. Oh, I heard that. No matter how many times you reinvent yourself, you know, you can't change your name and you can't, you know, and you can't dechronologize yourself.
In 1970, the president of Columbia Records, Clive Davis, suggested to Miles that he abandon the jazz clubs where he had made his reputation and begin to play the new, larger halls like the Fillmore in San Francisco to reach the big, young rock audience. Percussionist Ayrton Moreira, who joined Miles' band at this time.
We used to have the Grateful Dead in the same bill with us.
that if you more west. I mean, this was crazy. And the audience, they were rock and rollers, man. They were totally crazy. Everybody was on acid. They would dance anything. I remember in San Francisco, man, we would play this very complex stuff, like was like a ramble kind of thing. And the people, they were dancing. They were rolling in the floor and just, you know, it was like, wow.
The Grateful Dead's Bill Lesh.
Frankly, I was embarrassed to have to follow Miles. I felt there's no way that we can follow Miles. I had never heard the tapes from that show, and I don't think I'd want to because I felt we played like shit. But the best, the great thing about it was it didn't matter. I got to be on stage behind the amps when Miles was playing, and everybody in the band was up there with their chins down to their navels. Mouths open, ears open too.
Miles' band by now always contained an electric guitar and percussionist, both acoustic and electric basses, and two electric piano players. And once again, his band was the springboard for players who would later redefine the music. Among them were Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, Joe Zawinul, Billy Cobham, John McLaughlin, Entombé, and Keith Jarrett. Even among musicians who had reservations about Miles' current musical direction, few turned down the chance to join his band.
I wasn't exactly turned on by the band. I wanted to play with Miles.
Pianist Keith Jarrett.
And that was already an understanding with Miles, which is why, you know, even though it sounds weird, my direction didn't get changed. In some ways, it was regressive because the so-called free playing on those instruments is never free. You can't make an electric instrument free. It's not sensitive enough to be pushed around. So when we did those things at the Fillmore that are crazy, I mean, there was an incredible amount of will involved, but I don't think of that as very interesting music.
Saxophonist Gary Bartz.
When I went with Miles, it was all this electricity, and had wah-wah pedals, and they were so loud. I mean, that band was so loud, Keith would crank that thing up, and I was the only thing acoustic. And I would tear my lips up, you know, really, you know. I had a lot of nights, you know, I came back. I didn't think I was going to stay long, you know, but I grew to like it.
Miles has started a whole new genre of music, now called jazz fusion. He taught his musicians to use the basic vocabularies of rock and funk in open jazz-style improvisations. Drummer Lenny White.
There's four major fusion bands. And I will refute anybody with this. Tony Williams' Lifetime, Weather Report, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, and Return to Forever. Now, the principal elements of all of those bands were on the Bitches Brew record. John McLaughlin from Tony Williams' Lifetime,
Chick Corea with Return to Forever, and myself, Wayne Shorter and Joe Zawinul with Weather Report, and John McLaughlin with the Mahavishnu Orchestra. So like that album, you created something. There was no evolutionary process. It was a creation. It was something new on the horizon, something different, you know. And Bitches Brew was totally different. And from that, man, all those other bands came, and like you had a new movement.
Miles had succeeded in building a following among the young white rock audience. He also wanted to build his black teenage audience. Already serious young black musicians were listening closely to Miles. Two who were listening carefully were Maurice and Verdine White, who went on to form Earth, Wind, and Fire. Verdine White.
Sly was already a legend by that time. Hendrix was a legend. All of a sudden, Columbia Records and Warner Brothers discovered that there is black music for profit. That you mean niggas buy albums. Whereas we always had a history of buying 45s. As the mid-70s came along, everybody bought albums. It was a regular thing. So it was more blacks who in a lot of ways were competing, you know, in style and look, for different reasons. You had Herbie and them were coming up with their groups, which were smoking. McLaughlin, Return to Forever, all those cats were coming, which all of those guys played with Miles at one time or another. Then they got famous on their own. So it made Miles probably be part of a lot of the guys. So in order for him to be ahead, he had to push music, you know, which probably confused him because people weren't paying attention to him as much.
Miles was at another crossroads. His teaching and his music had spawned another generation of innovators who were becoming very successful artistically and commercially. But Miles had lost his place as the top box office draw in jazz and was now competing with his former players, again, Keith Jarrett.
He was running out of players. He was running out of people who could bridge as many worlds as he heard in his head because of all the musical interest, you know, all the things he liked in music were very disparate. He wanted this Motown bass player for a very good reason, rhythmically. But he had to trade knowledge away. You know, he had to have a bass player who didn't know what the hell the band was doing outside of this little rhythm pattern he was asked to play. Eventually, when Jack left, he had to find drummers that he and I talked about drummers for months, and no, we couldn't come up with anybody. So I think one by one, the players were not anymore in that other world that Miles was, in a way, coming from. And he had to make a choice, you know, what am I going to go crazy trying to find, you know, how am I going to replace this band?
This was the first time since Miles played with Charlie Parker that he was following others as much as leading them. During this period, Miles' dependency on drugs increased. In 1975, suffering from a bleeding ulcer, Miles broke up his band and went into what was supposed to be a temporary retirement. But this break stretched into a long tunnel of drug abuse and psychotic behavior. During this period, Miles went for as long as a year at a time without leaving his house. The actress, Cecily Tyson, re-entered Miles' life, trying to help him drop his heavy cocaine and alcohol habits. Miles Davis.
I asked the doctor, I said, why are my hands shaking and I have diarrhea and I'm sweating? He said, because you don't ever close your eyes and you're almost an alcoholic. So your liver is large. So I stopped drinking. Stopped using coke. Because one day I went to pick up something, my hand was like this. And Cicely calls it. So she was in Africa, so she came back and my hand was like this for about a month. So I stopped smoking, I stopped drinking, I stopped snorting coke.
By 1980, Miles hadn't recorded or performed in 5 years. In fact, he hadn't even picked up his trumpet once. CBS executive Dr. George Butler became interested in getting Miles out of retirement.
A number of executives had tried to get Miles back into recording, and of course, each person was unsuccessful. And I thought, well, let me at least demonstrate to Miles that he has a friend here. And of course, my ulterior motive was to get Miles back into the studio, but I was not going there talking specifically about recording. I thought I would focus my attention on 3 areas that I knew he enjoyed talking about, and of course they were boxing, cars, and clothes.
Butler nervously called Miles one afternoon. To his surprise, Miles asked him to come over the next day.
Miles kept the house very dark, you know. The blinds will pull, and the shades will pull. And as I recall, the only illumination was this Advent television that he kept on 24 hours, you know. And I remember going into Miles's place, not being able to see and feeling my way, you know, because I couldn't see where I was going. I know Miles was leading me up these stairs, and I didn't know where I was going, and I actually felt my way up to the second level of his brownstone. And I really can't tell you what was in the apartment of all the months that I spent there. I never really could see anything, you know?
Butler went to visit Miles every morning, 5 days a week for 6 months. For the first 5 months, the two men spoke about cars, boxing, and women, but not once about music.
I was getting a little bored thinking that I'm just spinning my wheels, that nothing's going to happen, you know. And Miles had a little piano. It wasn't even a spinet because it had less than 48 keys, you know, and perhaps only 5 or 10 of the keys worked. And one day he said to me in his tone of voice that he had some ideas. And he said, listen to this. And he played a chord, and I could only hear one note because the keys weren't working. And evidently he heard it in his head, but I was still trying to figure out whether this was a diminished chord or an augmented chord or whatever, you know. But at least he was talking about music.
Eventually, Butler persuaded Miles to go back into the studio to make a new record. Most of the jazz world had by now written him off as a has-been. But the idea that Miles Davis was going to come out of retirement and record had people buzzing with excitement. At the point of Miles' return to the studio, he had not even touched a trumpet in 5 years.
Well, the first thing I noticed when he walked in was that there was no horn. And I was looking at the fellows I had brought in and the sum of money that I was paying them and the hotels, and many of them were ordering room service sufficient for 10 people, and all I could think of was dollars, you know. And here's Miles Davis, no horn. And what I didn't realize was that he was orchestrating things. He wanted to make certain he had the right composition of musicians, you know. And of course, when Miles found the right combination, then I guess he felt like it's time for me to come in with my horn. Now, this took approximately 2 weeks. He came in with his horn. And of course, I got excited then and thought, whoa, Miles is going to record. You know, he's going to play the horn. And he put the horn up to his mouth. And of course, without the embouchure, all you got was wind and pfft, pfft, and that frightened me because I thought, I've paid out a fortune now. For 2 weeks, these fellows are in town, and Miles can't produce a tone. Each day, Miles's lip got stronger, and I could hear at least a facsimile of a tone. And the thing that impressed me about Miles, and is still impresses me today, is his power to bounce back, his resiliency.
Miles Davis finally returned to the music scene in 1981 with the album Man with the Horn. And on Thanksgiving Day that year, he and Cicely Tyson were married. Miles' musical direction was still influenced by the 60s stars like James Brown and Sly and the Family Stone. But it was now also inspired by the new black dance music that had hit the scene in his absence, most notably that of Prince. As always, Miles was deeply concerned with rhythms. Miles Davis.
Like Prince, if you listen to the bass drum and on his records, say, if he writes something, you hear like, you hear that, then he'll write something over it. And if you really listen to some of his stuff, he uses like nursery rhymes and things. Prince uses everything. My drummers, I use two drummers because I like polyrhythms. My drummers look at me like this. What, Chief? I said, just think of Mama Love, Baby Love, Short and Short and Bubba the Bump, Chip-Bump, Boom Bump, Bubba the Bump. But it locks it in when you tell them what to listen for.
In the early 80s, Miles began recovering his health and making music again. Many of his fans and fellow musicians admired Miles' new playing, but could not embrace the vehicle he was using to play over. Keith Jarrett.
I love the way Miles sounds now, and I every time I hear him play, I understand why he has going behind him what he has. But when he isn't playing, it's worse than ever.
Pianist Walter Bishop Jr.
That really could relate to what he was doing musically. And like the music didn't start anywhere, it didn't go anywhere, and it didn't end anywhere. And I went backstage, I was talking to Miles, I asked him, I said, Miles, what are you doing? So he didn't answer me. I said, what are you doing? He didn't answer me. I said, I tapped him, hey Miles, what are you doing? He said, you know what? I said, what?
People want shit.
End of conversation. I thought about that. And I also thought about the fact that the reason why he was so innovative and led the stuff for so long was that he could care less about people and what people wanted. We played for the integrity of the music.
Record producer Quincy Jones.
Everybody started talking about selling out. Man, if you want to sell out, you better have something to sell, you know? Because there was a time where we all believed that if we wanted to, just because we decided to and condescended to being accessible to the public, we could do it. That's bullshit, you know? Your soul has got to be pure enough. The public is not going for anything that you don't believe in.
Trumpeter
Lester Bowie.
I don't know when this is, but he ain't happening. I mean, he's up to date, and he has his sound. I mean, are these people deaf or what? I mean, he sounds pretty goddamn good to me. Every time I hear him, he sounds great.
Miles' new music and style in the 80s seem almost to personally offend some of his fans, especially those who knew him back when, those whose own growth was influenced by Miles Davis. Jazz critic Martin Williams.
The last time I heard him, it was a nightmare to me. He was standing up on stage in what looked like an old Halloween fright suit, stalking around, playing one or two plaintive notes, with these speakers on either side of the table who were bigger than this room, any one of them, or bigger than the room I first heard him play in. But the thing that bothered me the most was this deafening sound. And I feel about that, I felt about that the way I feel about so much rock music now. It gets louder and louder and louder to me because it's very frustrating. It's not saying anything. It doesn't have any story, and the musicians are so frustrated that they just keep turning it up and turning it up and turning it up and turning it up. And I felt the same way about it. And I'll tell you the truth, it gave me physical pains across my chest, that just the booming of those speakers. And I had to get up and leave, and I felt so sad, because that guy has been able to make beautiful music out of the dumbest pop song that attracts him, which, you know, something jazz musicians have always done. But almost anything he could turn into something very personal and very special. And yet I didn't hear anything coming out of this.
Producer Tommy LaPuma.
Listen, if I want to go out and hear bebop, I'll go and listen to one of the 4,000 albums I have in my record collection down in the bin, because that's when the shit was happening, you know? You know, for me to just go in and make the same records over and over again, man, would just be the most boring thing in the world. I think Miles feels the same way, you know?
In 1986, Miles left Columbia Records and went to Warner Brothers. He collaborated with his former bass player, Marcus Miller, and producer Tommy LaPuma. His first record for Warner Brothers was entitled Tutu, for South African cleric and liberation activist Desmond Tutu. Tommy LaPuma.
I'll never forget when we did Tutu, and he put his solo on there. You know, that was like the first time down. Bam, that was it. And I kept looking around the machine to make sure it was recording, because it was so good, and I was saying, man, I can't, am I getting this on tape? The next day when I spoke to him, you know, and I was just telling him just how excited I was over what we'd gotten, how great it sounded. And I asked him if he was coming down, and he said, man, he said, I got to take a couple days off, man, he said. And that was hard. So I realized that he had just, I mean, he had given it all. He just gave his all to the point of exhaustion. And, man, that's, you know, there's nothing else you can ask out of any artist, or musician, player, you know, is to just give you, you know, everything he's got.
These little particles of pastel, they come in like crumbs and rocks, and you put them on, and when they dry flat, they won't come off. But when they're in texture, like this, see, it's a knot. Like, so you can either leave it or work with it, you know.
Miles's need for expression is not limited to music. Over the past 10 years, he has spent an increasing amount of time painting. For him, there are clear parallels between music and visual arts. Here is Miles while painting at his California home.
You can balance this. I'm balancing this section right here. See this section of that? And if it's too much, see it? It's taking a whole total different shape. But I like that shape of tic-tac-toe, you know, like down and across. And I like contrary motion in music and art. And all this work, you'll see that I'll have a line that goes like this, and one like this. You know, see, this is straight. Like this way, this way, this way, this way. All of a sudden you see this line here, see, which makes it move, like in the sky when you see a falling star over here. It makes the painting move, it makes it come alive, you know. See, that's why this costs so much money. See all the time I'm putting in here, you understand? See this little bit in here? That's what you pay for that, right? And on top of that, my name. Plus my name. You know what I mean? You know, they might say, well, that ain't so good, but he did it.
Davis is an artist in all aspects of his life. The way he carries himself, the way he dresses, the way, you know what I'm saying? That's a true artist. He changed not only music, he changed the way people thought about music. He changed the way people thought about presenting music. He changed the way people thought about themselves.
Miles is one of the few that survived 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, going into the 90s, you know, that's going into a 60th year. And that's a long time to survive, and survive on your uniqueness.
His taste is so beautiful. The line, just the line drawing of it is like Matisse or Picasso, you know. Maybe it's because he draws. Maybe that added interest creates a dimension to his playing, to see the line before your eyes as it comes out, to say, oh, I'll wiggle there instead of there, you know. He's just a great artist. He's just a great artist.
Basically what he does is he brings his essence and he reshapes it like a painter. He brings it through each decade. The parallel between him and Picasso is really applicable, you know. The blue period, cubism, you know, that's what it's about. And he jumps into it, he sticks his foot into it, he's got a curious mind, he explores it. He's constantly creating to deal with the evidence that he's really, really an alive human being, you know, and he is.
If I write some music, if I want a sound, you use contrary motion, you can do that in art too. From one corner to the other, this comes down, this comes up. Sometimes when I get through the painting, I look at it and I say, it's no fizz there. So, you know, you have to be loose when you're an artist, you know, you just can't. When I look at a piece of art, it just shows you what you can do musically. You know, there's no rules.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is the Miles Davis Radio Project. Behind the scenes with Miles Davis. Miles Davis, the private man. In this program, we will have the opportunity to peek behind the scenes and hear some rare recordings of Miles Davis actually in the process of creating new music. During the next hour, we will take you into the studios of Columbia Records and listen to never-before-heard outtakes of some of Miles' classic recording sessions with John Coltrane, Gil Evans, and the great 60s quintet. Then we will visit an ultra-modern 24-track recording studio to learn how one of Miles' recent records was put together, sound by sound. And we'll end with a visit to Miles and his current band at a New York City rehearsal as they prepare for an extended road tour. Let's go back to October 27th, 1955. And listen to the creation of Miles' classic tune, Budo. The band is Philly Joe Jones on drums, Mr. PC Paul Chambers on bass, Red Garland on piano, and John Coltrane on tenor sax.
Miles, I like this much better now. We've put some echo on, which takes away the harshness. Let's take it right from the top, and if the balance between the two horns isn't right, we'll stop you right away. CO-54-133, take three.
That's producer George Avakian.
Yeah, Miles, try backing up a little bit more. Alright, take four. Sorry to do it again. Too much tenor now, that's it. Yeah, you got it. You back up too, John, and I don't think we'll get the right sound now. All right, this is take five.
The problem here is a technical one. The balance of loudness between the saxophone and the trumpet isn't quite right. Today, each musician would be on his own mic, and the engineer could adjust the volume from his booth.
Could we take it once again? begin from the top. There are a couple of little plans there. And John, again, we're getting a little spit sound. That's probably because you're blowing soft, you know. Yeah, if you go back, it'll enable you to blow a little stronger. Okay. Take eight.
This one, take eight, which is quite a strong performance, wasn't chosen for the LP. The balance between the tenor and the trumpet still wasn't quite right. Didn't offer much studio time to jazz and pop artists. Today, record albums take months, sometimes years, to make. Then, entire albums were recorded in just a few sessions. The band would start a tune and try to get through it without any mistakes. Everyone played at once. There were no overdubs later. If there was a problem right away, a false start, the leader or the recording engineer would stop the take and they would begin again. Usually, as soon as there was one complete take that satisfied both the leader or the producer musically and the engineer technically, that was it, and they went on to the next tune. One of Miles' most famous records is Sketches of Spain. Miles collaborated with his close friend Gil Evans. Among the session outtakes from the CBS tape vaults is the complete take of Miles' solo on Saeta.
This version contains about 50 seconds of material in the middle of his solo that does not appear on the record.
There you go. Take two.
Let me just hear it with the horns and trombones, the first chord. Horns and without the woodwind. Horns and trombones. Ready?
Material is very modern. Miles' solo consists principally of the exploration of a single exotic scale imbued with an Arabic sensibility. He is not playing over any quickly changing chord progressions here. This approach, which Miles used on his Kind of Blue album, was one of the major changes in the jazz language of the 1960s. The solo makes use of some non-standard trumpet techniques, including lip slurs, and is filled with passionate pitch variations. The next session you will hear was recorded at CBS 10 years later, December 1967.
This is take two.
Please smile there. Wait a minute, right? 1, 2, 2, 2.
Miles' second great quintet, Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, Herbie Hancock, and Tony Williams, were still together, but changes were on the way. The band would soon overturn completely as Miles entered another period of exploration. This session is one of the first where he brought in another voice to the band. It is the guitar of young studio player Joe Beck. Also, Miles has Herbie playing the delicate celeste instead of piano, a precursor to his work with electronic instruments.
There's too much in that, don't it? Just play it two times that way and two times the other key and back to the other key.
Right.
All right. Here we're gonna do this. God damn, where's the rhythm? Get up here. Rhythm of playing. One chords, not one chords, but one in that key before you go to the fifth above. Just play it once. Wayne will come in for the second time, and I'll play the middle with him, and y'all play that other, play the, go back to the other key and play that by yourself. All right? Now look here, you can play full, and Herbie, when you play Celeste, just play as full as you want. Alright, here we go.
Alright, here we go. We're rolling. Take four.
Keep a rhythm to it. One, two, one, two.
The method of recording pop music today is completely different than the method used to record Miles' classic albums. Everything is done now to multi-track machines, tape recorders that can record up to 24 or 48 distinct tracks simultaneously. They can be used to record a large band and rebalance the volumes later, or to lay the tracks down one at a time. Marcus Miller, who writes and arranged for Miles, uses this track-by-track technique.
The first thing that we did, or the first thing that I programmed, was this ride cymbal.
Here we have a unique opportunity to sit in a modern New York studio with Marcus Miller and producer Tommy LaPuma, and have Marcus explain step-by-step how he put together the title tune for Miles' album, Tutu.
That's the ride cymbal. And that's the thing that creates the wash over the music. It goes tss, tss. So then, to that, I figured if I were a bebop drummer, I'd probably be playing on with my foot a rhythm that went tch, 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 tch. So I added that with a cabasa sound on the drum machine. So there you have a sort of synthesized two feel. From like the 50s. So to that, I added instruments that would funk it up a little. So here's the bass drum. And the snare drum. Okay, roll back. Same place. Okay, so you listen to this and you hear that the jazz feel is going and the funk feel is going, but it still sounds a little stiff. And I'm thinking to myself, well, what can we use to make it dance so that you can really hear Miles on this thing? And I remember a beat that Miles had showed Al Foster when I was in the band. It was a little New Orleans beat. So I, let me see if I can find it first. There it is. See, that's the thing that's dancing around. So now we're getting closer, but it's still... That's a dude with three snares on this thing. There's the big, fat, greasy one.
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans, and then the... Okay, so now it's dancing, but it's still... It's not real convincing yet. So what I did then was once we got in the studio, I brought a little snare drum into the studio and played along. So you'll start hearing roughs now. Those things. Right here. Right here. That. So now you start really, you know, it starts sounding convincing now.
Right there.
So now I really started to feel like, you know, we're getting into something. Now, the thing that I had in my head all along. Is this okay, doing it like this?
Yeah. Perfect.
Okay.
Sounds great.
I'm giving away, man, some deep shit.
Sorry, I was just thinking about that.
All right. The thing that I had in my head all along when I first started writing something for Miles was that I wanted to write something that reflected his dark side. You know, the darkness of Miles. When you think of him, you think of the Prince of Darkness. You think of all these shadowy kind of figures. So, I figured I needed a bass line that did that. Now, that was done with a synthesizer. And the synthesizer has human voices in it. So what that is a sampled human voice. That you, when you play the keyboard, it just plays voices. So these instruments, the drum program and the voice bass line, basically create the atmosphere for the tune. So in order to augment the voice bass, I added my regular bass guitar, but I can't find it on the tape. There it is. Turn that up. So that makes the bass line a little thicker, so you get the eeriness of the voices, but it's still... And plus, you also get a little bit more movement. So, the last thing this could be was stiff. It couldn't be stiff because this is Miles. You know, you had to make sure that it swung. Couldn't find the bass. It's down there, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, it is usually down here, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. I figured it'd be down there with the guys. Yeah. Not up there with the flutes over here. So next thing we needed was a melody. So I think we have a melody here. chords that are under the melody. I always liked the way Herbie Hancock had voiced his chords under Miles' things. And although I know I couldn't do that, I want to just give that flavor. So roll back one more time. So that was a melody. I'd always liked the sound of the ensemble with Miles' Birds of the Cool records. You know, he always had these kind of muted instruments. I didn't really think it swung as much as some of the later things that Miles did, but the sound, I enjoyed that sound, and I wanted to try and incorporate that in the melody, so we added these trombones. So if you listen to the chords that I put under the melody, I was trying to evoke the kind of voices that Herbie would use when he was playing with Miles in the 60s. Real interesting chords that would be hard to name because they're more colors than real chords. So those are the chords that you hear underneath the melody. Now, I also, in the spirit of trying to combine these different eras of Miles, I wanted to add a sound that would remind you of the Birth of the Cool sessions from the late 40s. Or is it late 40s? So I decided to add some trombones. So I added some trombones. Now, these aren't real people. This is a sample trombone. One more time. I'll give it to you for real. Say, look, this is a little subtle. With that, I played a soprano sax. There's a soprano. So that was basically the ensemble sound. So now I've got the 50s, I've got the 80s with the funk, and I got the 40s with the Birth of the Cool. So now the actual tune is complete in terms of the sounds and stuff. So now it's just about having Miles perform. And so what happened was Miles came in. Miles had heard the demo earlier, so he knew basically the feeling of the song. What Miles and I did was we went out into the studio. I had my soprano. Miles had his trumpet. And basically Miles said, just play the melody to me. I played it to him. He learned it. And he said, okay, run the tape. And we start the tape. And Miles would begin to overdub his part. He'd tell me to hit him in the shoulder when I wanted him to come in. And he told me to hold my hand up when I wanted him to stop. And it was real hard at first because, you know, this was Miles Davis, and I was real intimidated, you know, not when I'm in the studio by myself, but when it came time to do him, it was kind of, I was a bit reluctant to tell him what to do. And so at first what we did was we just let the tape roll, and Miles just kind of noodled around, just playing whatever he wanted to play. And Tommy and I going, yeah, I guess that's, you know, finally Miles said, man, you got to tell me what to do, you know, this is your song. You have to direct me. So I began to direct him. And
I think also that he really enjoyed and felt, I mean, there was a certain comfort that he was getting out of, you know, having you out there mm-hmm. with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's understandable at first that you were intimidated by it, but I think that, you know, he made you feel that he was very comfortable with having him out there
mm-hmm.
giving him direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once Marcus felt that, then it was just, you know, it just started flowing.
Yeah. I just gave away exactly how we did it, reluctantly. But people, when you hear it, you really can't tell what's a machine, what's not a machine, how it was actually done. It just sounded good. You know, he just said, okay, it sounds good. So that was all the things kind of came together. And I never gave Miles music. I never told him what was coming next. And just the fact that he really didn't know what was coming next made him have to react quickly. And you get the spontaneity that way. It adds the excitement to a record that otherwise would be real kind of staid, you know. So where were we with this? Miles.
We were going to bring Miles in.
So Miles came in, and like I said, I was pointing to him. So he ended up playing, and I'm just going to play a little bit of the Miles track. So this section coming up is an interlude, and the interlude was supposed to evoke the feeling of South African workers working, you know, right here. So Miles is sitting there hearing this for the first time, just like you're hearing this for the first time. And he's off into it. You know, his eyes are closed, and he's enjoying it. And all of a sudden, I hit him on the leg and say, play, it's your solo. So, you know, the horn came through his mouth, you know? So what happens is that he's reacting just as if he was playing live. You know, it's not like he had worked this out or anything. For him to stop while the melody played, and then I pointed to him to fill in between the melodies. Get when you've heard something in your head for a while, and then you hear it come to life. When I hear Miles playing the thing and it sounds like I would hope it would sound, it's a great feeling. And Tommy's in the studio and he's going, yeah, I think we got something, you know? Because when you do something new like this, you're never really sure whether it's gonna work out or sound like a piece of garbage, you know? And when Miles put this on, you said, okay.
I think that was also, I can interject that this was one of two takes, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And I think what we ultimately ended up doing was using the first take. So this was really just spontaneity at its best. I mean, he just did it, and this was it, and there was no reason to. I mean, we took another take because we figured, you know, why not? But once we did the second take, we realized there was no sense in making a third, you know, that the first was it.
So, you know, it's a question of compromise, you know, give and take. In order to get the music to sound the way we want it, we had to sacrifice some of the spontaneity. You know, we had to say, well, look, there's not going to be a bass playing the drummer kind of playing together. But you try and get it in other ways, you know, to make it sound fresh. So after that, we've got Miles on tape. Now, what you need then is you need other musicians to react to Miles now that he's on tape. You need people so that it just doesn't sound like he's pasted on top. You need some people to react to him. So we had Paulinho da Costa come in, who's a percussionist from L.A., who's real musical. He's like one of the most musical percussionists that you'll ever hear. He just reacts real in a real sensitive way to the music that he hears. And we had him come in, and he put the percussion on. I think we have... this is the interlude section. And he realized this was an area he could really be colorful. And then Miles comes in and he hears this. Put a cap on the record, we had a guy who played in Miles' band at the time. His name was Adam Holson, and he had a couple of synthesizers that were very new and had some really interesting sounds. And can you go back to that section, that interlude section before Miles' song? And I played. Here's Adam. No, here's Adam. So, you can probably see that doing a record this way is more like making a painting. You know, you do something, then you stand back and you say, what do we need now? And then you add that, and then you build it up like that. And one of the talents that you have is the ability to stand back and finally say, it's finished. You know, because lots of times, a lot of people can't tell when there's nothing else to be added, and they keep adding and adding, and you get diminishing returns because the music starts getting crowded and you can't hear the different elements clearly, and you don't have as good a record. So basically, that's how this record was done. I grew up with Miles. All his periods I love, you know, and what I wanted to do was try and incorporate as many as I could so that people who knew about Miles would be able to hear that there's a lot of history in the music. And also the people who didn't know about Miles, it wouldn't really matter because the final product sounded like something that reflected the times that they lived in and something that they could relate to.
Finally, here's Tutu as it appears on the record. In March 1988, for the first time ever, Miles allowed a rehearsal of his to be recorded. What we have in the following session is literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to sit in on what amounts to a masterclass, a chance to experience the precision and insight which Miles brings to the rehearsal.
Take about 5 minutes. You mind?
Miles is now working with percussionist Rudy Bird.
Hey, Rudy, don't play nothing. Forget about grooving in 4/4. is in 6/8. It means you don't have a downbeat because he's got it.
He's got 1, 2, 3, 2, 2.
Right.
I've got what he's doing.
Wait, give your foot the first beat.
Constantly teaching me something on the drums, like yesterday at rehearsal. I became frustrated at first because, like he said, he demanded a certain amount. And the first thing I did was relaxed. He came at me, he wanted this rhythm. It was a 6/8 feeling that was something, you know, an African groove.
You can do it in that, right? All right, so, okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. Is that better? Regain. Uh-huh. Got it now, ain't you?
And this was just something, I was doing a polyrhythm, playing. He made me play 3 against a 4, 5 against a 3, you know, and he mixed it up. But after he explained it, I was so free. I felt so good. I wanted to stop and just scream and say, thank you, you know, because he said, and then after we stopped, he said, it felt good, didn't it? You know, and, so as a teacher, I think he's one of the best teachers. You know, he not only plays the trumpet, he plays the drums. I feel him playing the drums and the bass and the keyboards. You know, I feel him playing all over.
Oh boy, come here, all right. You're gonna get cute now.
I think he's one of the greatest teachers that we've had, you know, in our time.
Following session, Miles coaches keyboardist Bobby Irving and the rest of the band on the proper phrasing of a song that they are all learning. Miles' language, which seems strange at first, is a fluid blend of scat, gestures, and words. It functions ideally to express his notions about moments and movements in time, events too subtle, quick, and complex for ordinary expression.
Wait a minute. Bobby, it's in 6. 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3. Don't say it. No, listen to what I'm praying. Wainwright's in 6. It's church, sanctified music, right? Oh, he's always doing like it's a train. Remember that shit I tried to get Nelson to play? All right, you hear me playing, man, because I'm going to leave it. Hey, man, where is that motherfucker? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Miles is working on the rhythmic foundation with the drummer, Ricky Wellman, and the bass player, Daryl Jones.
It's not da-da.
Just different phrasing. Da-da, instead of da-da, instead of the first one, instead of the last one being heavy, right.
So I told you, make it real light, man.
Okay.
If you can't play, just put your bass foot.
I think the drums are too loud.
They are too loud.
Something like that,
you? No. Hey, play it right. Did you give me a Coca-Cola? Do I have a Coca-Cola, Michael?
Mike, I got a Coke.
Come on, Adam. Go ahead. Go ahead, play the thing, man. Play it.
We had a demo tape of a tune by a musician in Los Angeles named Wayne Lindsay, who wrote a couple tunes for Miles.
Keyboardist Adam Hulsman.
We start off by listening to the tape, and the band, you know, cops the different parts off the tape, and we start working up the tune. When he showed up, we were playing, you know, pretty much what was on the tape. But then he started kind of hunting around for other parts and kind of turning the rhythm around a little bit. So it went from being kind of a straight 6/8 groove into almost a waltz. And it was interesting because he very often what will happen is he'll try out 10 different ideas and then go back to the first one.
What he said. Do that. Wow.
Do it
again,
too.
Da-da-blap. Yeah.
Da-da-blap. Okay, two, three, four.
That's right. Play it half like that. Bam. Right. Ready, bruh. Bop-bop-bop-boom. Now, down, hit that note.
Keyboardist Bobby Irving.
He'll call me over to the keyboard, and he'll play something. And he said, do this. And then when I start to walk away to do it, he'll play it again, and it's completely different. And I'm not sure if I'm supposed to play both of the phrases that he just showed me or what, and then I'll ask him to clarify it further, and then there's something completely different. Like, so there's a third phrase, and so I'm completely perplexed as to what to do. And in the end, he trusts my intuition to interpret it and come up with the right things.
You don't have to get that. I have to beat it if you don't want to.
Yeah, if you want it, I
want
to get it.
I want it to alter you. When you alter it, you do that. You know? But you got to get real late. Don't play it at all. Don't play it too heavy.
Adam Holzman.
He really doesn't miss anything. Sometimes you think that there's a little part that you're trying to sneak in there or something like that, and you think you're getting away with it, and 2 weeks later he'll say, I heard that shit you were playing there. Why didn't you play what I tell you to play?
Play that what I tell you to play. Play what I told you to play.
He said before that that the parts of music that interest him the most sometimes are the little background parts that kind of add, I guess, to the overall mood. And so he can get real particular about little details and get, you know, we can get kind of like stuck on a little section for a while. But then when the whole band starts to run the tune in a live situation, all the things he was talking about and all the little riffs he's trying to get out in rehearsal start to make more sense, you know, when you actually get on the gig.
Bobby, that sound is too sissified. Play it down in there. Yeah. Yeah. Take a duck and do it. So you just say, bop, bop, bop. No, don't do that. Duck, bop, no. Bop, bop, bop. Like that. Quad triplets. Yeah, just say, and don't do that. Okay, try again.
Rudy Bird.
He explains it in songs.
That thing he wrote.
Nat King Cole's a merry old soul, and a merry old soul was he. That a merry and a merry and a merry that, you know, and you continue like that. That's like a little nursery rhyme. You know, you use nursery rhymes. But every day before we get on stage, you know, he would say, Rudy, don't forget that rhythm. And somehow I don't.
After you do that, you hear the rhythm be telling, and Darryl's playing. So you gotta leave that spot. Don't shake your head, man. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, boom.
You really have to be able to think.
Drummer Ricky Wellman.
All the time. Because at any given time, during any given tune, the tune is subject to change right then and there. And you have to be sharp enough as a musician to relate with Miles to do that change right there. And you've learned a lot if you can develop that mentality from studying behind Miles Davis. He's a thinker, and he damn sure makes you think.
I told you I didn't want that sound, man. I don't like that sound. It's too sissified and it gets in the way. Play a soft DX7 piano. Down, not loud. No, what's it called? Reverb. Can you know that we've been on this tour for about a hour? None of that, man. I don't want that, Bobby. Bobby, I hear you, right? Don't use that live volume pedal, man, please. Man, play the new roll that I just got. Now play rolling bottom. Yeah, use that. That's enough of that. Whoa, my dings. Wow. Boy, wait now. One, two, three, four, five. It's shuffle all the way through.
I mean, he has this great freedom. He lets you try something, you know, and if it doesn't work, he'll let you know. And if it works, he'll let you know. And that's where you have to think for yourself. You know, Miles will have you think for yourself. And that's where the learning comes, you know.
Guitarist Foley McCreary.
It's an emotional roller coaster, you know, sight and sound, man. You go through so many things. And it's, you know, everything changes. It's never the same. He hates that. And that's some pretty incredible stuff. That's why he's Miles Davis.
I guess one of the differences between him and a lot of guys is he seems to be able to get musicians to understand his vision in some kind of strange way, you know, about what he hears in the music.
Bass player Daryl Jones.
I learn something every night. Every time I'm with Miles, I learn something. I mean, it's challenging to just stand next to Miles, you know, and have a conversation with him. And so I just love that, and I love him. I just love, you know, he's got this real special thing. And the longer I'm with him, the more I learn about it, and the better it makes me.
Enough of this.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is the Miles Davis Radio Project. In this special 2-hour program, we are going to listen to rare and never before released tapes of Miles Davis live.
What, they gonna run it down once? Go ahead then. 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, bam, 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 bam. Wait now. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Miles Davis hasn't released a live recording in over 10 years. The band Miles tours with has never released a record. We are happy to present the first live recording of the current Miles Davis group, taped during their 1988-89 tour. The tapes are of 2 exciting shows, one in New York City at Indigo Blues and the other at the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano, California. In addition, we'll listen to some rare live tapes of Miles' best bands over the years and hear some stories about what it's like to play with Miles Davis. This is the Miles Davis Group live at Indigo Blues in New York City. December 1988. Thank you.
Thank you.
Miles Davis, live. We heard In a Silent Way, The Intruder, and a tune simply entitled The Blues. Kenny Garrett on saxophone, Foley McQuarrie on lead bass guitar. Miles Davis has lived the life of the road, performing all over the world for almost 50 years. One of his earliest musical experiences was playing with Bird, Charlie Parker. It was probably one of the greatest experiences a young musician could have, but it was also sometimes exasperating. Here, Miles recalls a particularly difficult time they once had. He's speaking to an audience at the Studio Museum of Harlem.
We went out on the road. The first job we played was in Chicago on the north side, where all the gangsters were. Bird came in about 2 hours late. And he peed in the telephone booth, and it ran out in the on the floor. So the man says, get the f*** out of here. So Max said, man, we're going, Bird going to get the money. I said, where? Well, what? See, the union. So we went to the union the next day. And Bird came in and said, give me the, I want the money. And President Graves, they had two unions. They had a white union and a black union. President Graves picked up the gun and said, get the f*** out of here. And Max said, I said, I told you, man. You know, the Bird's going to take care of everything. So we had to leave Chicago. Nobody got paid.
They may have had problems, but the music they played was fantastic. Here's a rare live recording made during Miles' trip to California with Bird in 1946. Let's go back to Indigo Blues, December 1988.
We're gonna play the new song, right? Wait a minute, Ricky, come on, man. Hannibal. What? Oh.
was Hannibal. What? Kenny Garrett, saxophone.
There's your fault.
This tune features a young keyboardist from Philadelphia, Joey DeFrancesco.
Thank you. know.
Joey DeFrancesco on piano. One of Miles' great contributions has been to simply let musicians have room on the bandstand to play. His secret has been to pick the right musicians.
Coltrane was an incredible player, and I've heard Coltrane played when he made my hair stand on end. It was incredible.
Saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
I remember going to see Miles' group once at the Black Hawk when Cannonball and Coltrane and Red Garland and Chambers and Philly Joe were with him. And I went in, and they started playing a medium blues. Miles played three choruses. Cannonball played about 13 choruses. Coltrane played for about 45 minutes. And then we started on the rhythm section. And then Red Garland played, and Chambers played. Well, it was one endless set. They played one piece, and I heard, when Miles came on, I said, "Miles, I came to hear you. You only played three choruses." And he said, I said, couldn't you get Coltrane to play a little bit shorter? He said, "You tell him." So I try to tell him. He doesn't listen to me. I said, "Man, I can't tell him. It's your band." And it's true. Inside that 45 minutes that he played, man, he achieved incredible musical climaxes about four times. You know, you get it, and you're exhausted.
Here's Miles and Coltrane, recorded live at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1958. trumpeter Oludara.
A studio can make a monkey sound good. Seriously. So therefore, you never hear the great music. If you just mostly into records, you only hear a smidgen of what's really actually happened here on Earth musically. If you just into records, live music, completely different. Miles Davis to me sounds different live than he does on record.
Singer artist Joni Mitchell.
In Miles' sensitivity, like to a vibe in the front row, this is how I imagine Miles. I don't walk around in his body, but I look at him. I figure. If he walks over, I see how he plays with his guitar player in this band that he has now. I think he goes there for warmth. He goes there, he puts his hand, you know, on the guy's shoulder, and he plays. He goes there to charge up, to get, it looks like he's plugging in to get some heart from this kid. Like he singles him out for his heartbeat.
Thank you.
Foley McCreary, lead bass guitar.
Hallelujah.
Benny Rietveld, bass.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah, my God.
You are listening to the Miles Davis Radio Project Music Special on American Public Radio. Thank you. I'm Danny Glover, and you are listening to the Miles Davis Radio Project Music Special. We're taking a unique look at Miles Davis in performance from his 1988-89 U.S. tour and at some rare tape from past live performances.
Okay, what was that bunch of quarter inches you just had? Was that the audio line to the DI?
That's the audio to the keyboards. The audio keyboards. From the keyboards to the mixer.
Today, Miles brings a five-man road crew to handle all the equipment needed to present the band. Drummer Art Blakey remembers when just one microphone was used for the entire band.
We didn't have no microphones and stuff like the bands have today. We had one microphone, so you had to play in such a way that you could hear every instrument. It was good training. A musician up front would be playing a solo. The bass didn't have no amplifier. And the band be playing the background behind, so you had to play soft enough to hear everybody. Plus the soloists, especially the soloists, because that's who you're playing for. You know, not playing for yourself, you're playing for the solo, back the soloists up. And it made better musicians at that time. And you listen to the bass, no amplifier, be in a great big hall or something. And sometime in the South, they'd really be singing with a megaphone. Here, you know, well, that's what you have to go through.
Let's go back again to Indigo Blues. This is Winkle.
You want to do it again? Hey Gordon, how you feel? Thank you. Joey. I just want to hear you play, Ricky. Goddamn.
Here is Miles' version of Perfect Way.
Thank you.
Miles Davis live at Indigo Blues in 1988.
I just remember one night he came up to the mic and the joint was noisy. I mean, it was real loud, you know.
Bassist David Holland.
He came up to the mic and he just sat right on that mic and put his horn into the mic and started playing on his own, the introduction to the song. And it was like there was a cone of silence around him. You know, I mean, the noise was still going on, but in that space that he was, there was nothing but the music. It was really, you know, it was like he created the context. And that cone gradually expanded out into the crowd, you know, until the whole place was like centered on what he was doing, you know. But it started just with him getting really down into the music. Now, that to me, that's what I mean by thinking. I don't mean like intellectualizing everything so much as being focused like that. When he came down to play, he was focused. And that focus would spread into the, you know, into the band. You'd have to respond to it. You'd have to be there. And that night, I saw the power that he had to just like bring everything down. And because, you know, there were all kinds of canting going, all kinds of noise happening in the club. And this beautiful thing that he started on the mic just gradually took over the whole place.
Let's go to the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano, California. This is Mr. Pastorius, a dedication to the late bassist Jaco Pastorius. Thank you. Here's a tape which was recently rediscovered of Miles with Chick Corea, Dave Holland, Wayne Shorter, and Jack DeJohnette, recorded in Paris, 1969. Pianist Keith Jarrett.
We were playing at a club in Boston, and Miles was very sick. So he was just about able to play, and he was probably in terrible pain. And he started playing these old ballads around midnight, and I don't know what we played. I don't remember the tunes. And after the set, we went backstage, and Miles was sitting on a table, and he was kind of bent over, and he was in pain, and he said something like almost exactly these words: "You know, the reason I don't play ballads anymore is because I love to play ballads so much." Well, okay, so, yeah, profound. But really, what it's much more profound even than it sounds, because it can explain, if you want it to. It can explain how he's willing to take things. He's willing even to miss the music as long as he's doing something he didn't do before or in a situation he's not in, hasn't been in before. He didn't want to play them because he loved to play them so much. I mean, and then on another, in another way, that is also the most creative thing anyone can say. You know, they see themselves play a habit pattern on their instrument, and they like it, so they have to get rid of it.
Miles did stop playing ballads for a while, but he's playing them now. This is Miles' version of Cyndi Lauper's hit, Time After Time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Miles Davis live at Indigo Blues in New York. That was Prince's song called Movie Star. The Brazilian percussionist, Ayrton Moreira.
I played with that band and I looked down. Because if you look at Miles, then you have to be at his level. And I was not, you know, at his level. And so I wouldn't dare to look at him. But sometimes when I really felt that I was playing with him, then I would look at him. Because, you know, sometimes he would come close to me and not playing, and just he would stand up right in front of me and watch me play. And I had my, you know, I had long hair, so I had my hair all in my face, you know, and maybe I was an acid or some, you know, because I was, at that time I was pretty crazy. And I wouldn't look up, and then I would see his boots, you know, beautiful shoes and beautiful boots. And riding, I knew he was looking, he was watching me.
Miles Davis live at the Isle of Wight Festival, held in Great Britain in 1970. We're back at the Coach House. This is the title track of Miles' album called Tutu.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Danny Glover, and this has been a blast. Thank you for listening to the Miles Davis Radio Project.